Dentistry is changing. Technology, education, and resources are closer to our fingertips now more than ever. Are you ready to learn what millennial dentists are doing to exceed patient expectations, enjoy dentistry more, and take more vacations? Or how this generation can join up with the previous ones to make for an unstoppable dental team? Well, wait no longer. Here are your hosts of The Millennial Dentist, Dr. Holsinger, Dr. Payray, and Dr. Sully Sullivan.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Millennial Dentist.
Woo woo!
For all you people out there, you know that this is an exciting episode for me because we talk about this all the time. And we have finally gotten the white coat investor on. So, Jim Dolly, welcome to the Millennial Dentist podcast, man.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
First off, I guess, tell us about yourself. Tell us about the white coat investor. I kind of want to hear your journey because a lot of people, they've gone to the blog, they've read the book, they've seen the stuff, but give us a little bit of your backstory on how the heck this all happened. And we will probably rudely interrupt you and ask questions as you go. But I feel like that's sure. A great place to start.
Yeah, feel free to interrupt at any time.
Okay.
So I grew up in Alaska and never really left the state. I think I left three times between the time I was born and the time I was 18. And went away to college in Utah, went to Brigham Young University, studied molecular biology, was interested in pre-med pretty much the whole time, and had no interest whatsoever in personal finance or business or anything like that. No interest at all. And then finished undergraduate, went on to the University of Utah School of Medicine, studied medicine there. By my second year or so, I pretty much knew I was going to go into emergency medicine.
How'd you kind of make that decision? Just out of curiosity.
They have the lunch and learns and the different specialists come in and talk to you. And the guy comes in and talks about emergency medicine. And I said to myself, self, that guy's just like you. It's pretty obvious. You know, I mean, I didn't know for sure until I rotated in it as during my third year, but it was pretty clear by that point that that's where I was headed. But still, no interest whatsoever in personal finance or investing or business or any of that stuff. I was interested in medicine. And so I went away to residency at the University of Arizona. This would have been about 2003. And a few months into it, I went to see a financial advisor that one of my residency colleagues had recommended. And so we sat down and he set us up with some Roth IRAs and some mutual funds and some disability insurance and life insurance. And we walked out and felt like all was well, we were on our way, right?
You're set.
Making money finally.
Yeah, good, go.
Got everything lined up. So I go on vacation a few months later. And while driving through Salt Lake, I think it was, I stopped in a bookstore and bought a book. The first financial book I'd ever read. It was Mutual Funds for Dummies by Eric Tyson. And as I'm reading through there, I'm like, okay, there's multiple different kinds of mutual funds. There's these A loads and B loads and C loads, you know, different types of commissions. And then, wow, there's these mutual funds without loads. That must be what I have, because I'm sure this guy wouldn't put me into a loaded mutual fund. So when I got home from the vacation, I looked it up, and indeed, I was in a loaded mutual fund, which made me very angry, because I thought I was paying him a fee each year to cover his costs, not also paying him with commissions. And so that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. At that point, looking back, I realized that I'd been ripped off by nearly every kind of financial professional there was, by a realtor, by an appraiser, by a recruiter, by a financial advisor, by an insurance agent. And I said to myself, if I don't start learning about this stuff, I'm just going to continue to be taken over and over again and never really get where I want to go. And so I lived near a used bookstore and went over there and just started grabbing financial books. And I read a bunch of terrible financial books, but a few good ones. And after a while, I went online. I was interacting on forums, on the internet, and reading blogs. And after a few years of doing that, at this point, I'd kind of finished residency and hit the ground running as an attending physician. But after a few years, I realized I was doing a lot more teaching online than I was learning.
How did you, when you were kind of starting to go through those books and obviously with the mutual fund, you were, that was related to you, but were there certain areas like insurance or loans, or like, how did you kind of walk through your journey in that? Cause I think that's cause sometimes it can be overwhelming. I feel like when people are like, I want to start learning about this, but where the heck do I start? And for me, it was definitely kind of like, well, what was the thing that was affecting me at the time was what I was like, would learn about, right? So if like when I had to buy disability insurance, like I read everything on your blog about disability insurance, right? And then I kind of like move on. So how did you kind of transition through that? Like, were there certain big pain points that you kind of learned about?
Well, I mean, you had an advantage I didn't have, right? You had the White Coat Investor blog.
That's a fact. Yeah, it's all in one place.
All the stuff I learned there, you know, I collected from a bunch of different books and a bunch of different places on the internet and from the School of Hard Knocks. And, you know, I mean, that's what the White Coat Investor is all that stuff compressed and I've tried to make it into a high yield resource of just in time learning. So when you want to learn about 401ks, you can go and read about 401ks. Or when you want to learn about disability insurance, you can go learn about disability insurance. But I didn't really have that option. So I kind of had to dig through the internet and through various books and find it one piece at a time.
Well, you probably didn't have Google back then either. So
no, there was Google, but I spent a lot of time on the Boglehead's forum. I don't know if you've ever been on there.
Yeah, of course.
It's a forum dedicated to Jack Bogle and his investing philosophy. But at one point, I was the sixth or seventh or eighth most prolific poster on there. So I was on there all the time. And, you know, learning and teaching and interacting there. And I think about 2011, they asked me to do some work on the wiki. And it looked like a lot of work. And at that point, I was kind of thinking, you know, I'm kind of interested in passive income. And I was looking at various ways to get passive income. And I looked at all that work to work on that wiki. And I said, if I'm going to do that much work, I want to make a buck off it. And so the White Coat Investor came from two different goals I had. One was to see if I could get some passive income. It turned out not to be nearly as passive as I thought it might be. It's been a lot of work, actually.
Very active, passive.
And most importantly, I wanted to help other docs, physicians, dentists, you know, really any high-income professional, get a fair shake on Wall Street and really get this information that the financial services industry is sometimes not so forthright in supplying to us. And so that was my goal when I started. I wanted to quit having to type the same thing again over and over again into Bogleheads and other forums and just be able to post a link where I'd answered that question on my website. And so that was the origin in May 2011 of the White Coat Investor. And it grew quickly, you know, as far as getting this information out. It didn't grow quickly as passive income. In fact, it was probably about 3 years before I started making any significant money at all. But it was really gratifying because I could see I was helping a lot of people and it was growing quickly. And I was really, you know, helping achieve that goal of helping others to get this information. And so that part was really gratifying. About 2014, which is about the time I started getting real serious with it as a business, I wrote the book, The White Coat Investor, A Doctor's Guide to Personal Finance and Investing. And it took off. It became an Amazon bestseller. It's been an Amazon bestseller in its category ever since. And it's really helped me get this message to people that will read a book, but won't necessarily follow a blog. And so since then, we've added newsletters and podcasts and a video channel and courses. And, you know, every time I can think of a way that I can get this message to more people, we implement it. So it's been a lot of fun.
How did you manage your time? So were you working at the same time of all this going through 2011 or how? When did you graduate?
So I graduated from residency in 2006.
Okay. Were you married, have kids, anything like that at the time?
I was married at that point with one kid and then went into the military. I had the military 4 years. They paid for my med school. And so the Air Force stationed me out in Virginia, deployed me all over the world. Over those 4 years, I practiced medicine on four different continents, had a couple more kids, and then got out in 2010 and joined a private practice in just south of Salt Lake. And that's where I've been ever since. But this whole time I was starting the White Coat Investor, I was working full time. In fact, I just cut back to three-quarter time about a year ago. And I'm still working three-quarters time, shifts in the ER. You know, I worked last night. I'm going to work in about an hour. And I'll be there till 2 a.m. tonight. You know, I mean, I'm still working. I'm a practicing doc. This is pretty much all on the side, right? I think next year I'm probably cutting back to half time, though. It's just become too much. I'm working about three-quarter time at the hospital and three-quarter time on this. And there's just no reason for me to be doing that much work. And so I'm working on trying to draw some boundaries around the White Coat Investor and keeping it from consuming my life.
Sure. Have you gotten a lot of criticism from doing the whole White Coat Investor from other people? I imagine in the industry, it's shaken up a lot of stuff from an industry that likes to kind of go after the high-income professional. Have you taken a lot of criticism for it?
I take criticism mostly from two different groups of people. The main one is insurance agents, particularly insurance agents that want to sell doctors life insurance products they don't need. like whole life insurance. So I get a lot of flack from them. I get a lot of flack as well from commissioned salesmen that are masquerading as financial advisors, you know, these commissioned mutual fund salesmen, basically. I get a lot of flack from them, but that's about it. I don't get a lot of flack from anybody else. Most doctors are very grateful to get this information, even if they have a little bit different investing philosophy or whatever. You know, they're usually good enough to take what's useful and leave the rest. And so I don't mind those interactions at all. You know, all of us have a little bit different perspective on money and can learn from each other as far as that goes. But my beef's with those who are just out there looking at doctors as whales and trying to harpoon them and milk them for all they're worth. You know, I don't feel bad a bit that those guys don't like me.
So I think what would be kind of fun to do is walk through a little bit of like the scenarios that new graduates are graduating with and kind of how they're, what they're doing, and kind of get some of your take on that, you know, and some of the issues that are rising. So
hot takes. All right. Let's do it.
You know, a little bit of that. So kid graduates from dental school this year and they've got, you know, $300,000 in student debt.
Wow. He did pretty good.
He did pretty good. I know. we could say more if we need to. And he's trying to figure out what type of job he should do. He should be an owner. Should he buy into a practice? Should he go work for a corporate job? And I don't know how familiar you are with like the dental side of it as far as from that standpoint goes, but where do you even start to kind of talk to these students who are graduating with this much debt who don't necessarily have an option for a forgiveness program? Because dentistry has a lot fewer options for those type programs.
Right. You're pretty much, as a dentist, you are pretty much paying back your loans. Now, the likelihood of you getting something that qualifies for public service loan forgiveness is pretty low, you know, barring some sort of Indian Health Service position or homeless clinic position, that sort of a thing. And so you got to plan from the beginning that you're probably paying these loans back. And what that requires is for you to live very inexpensively for a few years so that you can take the difference between what you were living on and what you're earning and put that toward your loans. And so you're also faced with this tough career decision right at the beginning. You know, the easy answer is to go be an associate somewhere for one of these national firms. And you got, you know, a guaranteed income there and guaranteed hours, and you'll make a certain amount of money. It might only be $120,000, $130,000, $150,000 a year, but at least you don't have to buy into anything. And so that's what a lot of people choose to do. The difficulty with that is if you owe $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, that $120,000 doesn't go very far toward paying those loans off. And so I'm a big fan of entrepreneurship and ownership. I think when you own things, you not only work a little bit harder, but you also reap the benefits of ownership. And while that often requires additional work, it also usually, if you do a good job at it, means higher pay. And it's way easier to pay off $300,000 worth of loans when you're making $250,000 than it is when you're making $120,000. And so I think that's often a good idea. The difficulty comes in when if you got to come up with another $500,000 loan to buy the practice. And you know, I think in a lot of ways, you're better off taking that practice loan than you are taking a house mortgage on the big fancy doctor house. Maybe you ought to rent for a little while or get someplace really inexpensive and buy the practice first rather than buying the big fancy house.
But I've made it, Doc. I'm a big old dentist now.
Isn't that funny that we all think that?
Yes.
Yet coming out of dental school, you are the poorest person in America, right?
Yeah. But I mean, I knew nothing,
bum,
really.
That bum under the corner is richer than you are. His net worth is zero.
Yeah.
Yours is minus 300,000. You're poor. So you need to live like it. You know, at least live, you know, maybe not quite like a dental student. Give yourself a little raise. Give yourself a 50% raise even. You know, that's huge in corporate America. But you can't grow all the way into your income. If you grow all the way into your income right away, you're never going to pay off those loans. You're never going to be able to pay for your practice. And you're going to be stuck in that associate job your entire career.
One thing I love about that too is, and we talk about this a lot of times, is the beauty of buying a practice and doing that is really what you're doing is betting on yourself. I mean, you're investing in your opportunity to really do it. You know, that to me, if I have to put my chips somewhere, I want to put them on me getting it done. You know, I don't want to hope that they're going to help give me a raise or they're going to put me in a position. That's what I love about that kind of position.
For sure. Your best investment is always in yourself. I mean, that's why you took out all those loans to go to dental school.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you know, buying a practice and getting started that way is another investment in yourself and will likely pay similar dividends to all those loans you took out in dental school. So I love the ownership. I know it's not for everybody, but if you got a lot of loans, you got to at least think about it seriously.
Talk a little bit about the difficulty, because then what happens is, okay, so we start to figure out, okay, we got a job now. We want to pay down our loans, but at the same time, we don't want to neglect retirement. How do you, and what's your advice to those who want to start to put money away, but they just have this huge retirement, I mean, this huge loan payment every month, or this, you know, mortgage payment, or this office payment? How do you kind of navigate the investing in your retirement versus paying down debt at that current point?
Well, there's no exactly right answer. I mean, there's a right answer for you, but not necessarily for every, it's not the same answer for every person. A couple of things to think about when you're thinking about these issues. Number one, you probably want to be out of debt in 2 to 5 years. And so you need a plan to get those student loans paid off relatively quickly. And if that's going to require a huge chunk of your discretionary income, you know, the difference between what you're living on and what you're earning, then you're going to have to put a huge chunk toward it. If you were lucky, managed your debt well, maybe got a little help from family, came out only owing $150,000 or something like that, well, you probably can either get out of debt a lot faster, or you don't have to put quite as much toward it. That person can probably afford to invest a little bit more than someone who owes $400,000. For almost all that discretionary income, those first few years is going to be going toward your loans. But the way I look at it is, if you're really living as cheap as you ought to be, you ought to be able to do both max out your retirement accounts and also get those loans paid off in less than 5 years. But you know, you can always invest more. There's no upper limit on what you can invest. But I really don't think you're going to be happy if you drag out your dental school loans for 10, 15, 20 years. I think you're going to regret that, and you're going to feel chained to the chair if you don't get that taken care of.
Well, and we've talked about that with one of our buddies before, about the tricky part with student debt versus, you know, practice debt or your home debt, is that you are somewhat chained. Even though mathematically it may not be that different kind of a debt, there is an emotional kind of bond to that, because you literally are chained to that. Like, you can't sell off your education and the debt go away, right? Versus, like, yeah, you could sell your practice and the debt goes away. And that is an interesting, I've kind of really come to that realization of, what, you know, getting student debt paid down quicker, there's a benefit to that because of that reason.
Right. I mean, it's like you've taken out a mortgage on your brain and you got to get it paid off before somebody forecloses, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, but you're right. You can sell your practice at any time, and likely, you know, you have some equity in there and you can walk away with something positive. Same with your home most of the time. But, you know, a student loan is a lot like credit card debt. You know, it's money you've already spent and now you got to pay for it. And you're not really done with dental school until you paid it off.
So now, when you talk about that, are you, like, for example, what about the people that are, their interest rate is for their student loans about 5% or 4.some%? What if they say, like, instead of me paying off my student loans, what if I buy a practice or do this and that, like other entrepreneurship, that they'll be like, okay, well, forget about my student loans right now. I'm going to collect more money and get more loans because my interest rate is not really that high. For example, if there's an opportunity for me to be able to make more money right now, I'd rather invest and risk that route versus paying off this loan for a student loan. Like, do you have anything to say to them as far as taking more risk, and but they know faithfully, like, they're going to be able to make so much more money by taking that entrepreneurship route of doing something else, property investment or something else? Like, what do you think about that as far as the interest rates and if it's low or high for some other folks?
Yeah, there's no doubt that mathematically, if you can borrow at 4% and earn at 8%, you're going to come out ahead. The problem is, I see a lot of people that kind of think that way and don't. They don't take the difference and invest it, if that makes sense. Instead, they go buy a boat or they buy a Tesla or whatever, you know. And so behaviorally, I think, you know, sometimes the right answer is paying off your debt, even if you think you can invest at a higher rate. But when we're talking about borrowing money to build something, to invest in something, you want to make sure you're getting a good return on that money. I think you can justify that in, you know, borrowing money to go to medical school or dental school. I think you can justify that in opening up a practice. But I don't know that you can borrow at 5 or 6% and justify that just to go invest in mutual funds. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You better be expecting a very good return on your investment if you're going to be borrowing at 4 or 5% to pay for it. Now, if you came out of medical school or dental school in 2003, the year I did, when my entire class refinanced at 0.9%, you know, I mean, I think you can justify investing instead of paying that off a little more, you know. Wow. I mean, when inflation itself is higher than that, then I think, yeah, you can justify hauling that debt around for a little while. But as you get into that 4, 5, 6%, 8% that a lot of people's student loans are at, that's probably your best investment to pay down that 8% student loan. It's not deductible. It doesn't go away in bankruptcy. You know, it's high interest. That's a good investment to pay that down.
The only thing I say to that sometimes is I'll tell people the behavioral thing is, if you'll take the opportunity to max out some of your retirement plans first, then when it gets to the end of the month and you got to make your student loan payment, you're more likely to like not go out to dinner to make sure you get the payment, right? Like
versus
doing it the flip side.
You got to know yourself and you got to use those behavioral tricks, especially in the beginning before you really start acquiring much wealth.
Yeah, because once you start to see it,
it works. It also helps if you refinance those loans. You know, a lot of times if you're willing to take a variable 5-year loan, you may be able to get your rate down to 3%, at which point a whole lot more of your payments going toward principal than it was when you were paying 6 or 8% interest.
That's a good point.
What do you think is holding people back from doing that? Just the fear of all of a sudden the loan is now more, like the government's not going to forgive it or something like that. Is that why people don't do that? Or what do you think holds people back from that?
Well, I think there's a few things that hold people back. One, they don't know about it. There's a lot of people that still don't know they should refinance their loans, which I find amazing. I've just been preaching it like crazy since you first became able to do it again in 2013. But also, it's inertia, right? You're just stuck in the rut you're in, making the payments you're in, and you're concentrating on other stuff. You're concentrating on your family and your practice or whatever. But I think there is a little bit of that fear to take a 5-year loan. And there's a little bit of fear to take a variable rate loan. But if you're truly committed to getting out of student loan debt in less than 5 years, you're making huge payments, right? So even if your interest rate goes up a little bit, you can still make huge payments. Maybe you're in debt a couple months longer. But people got to realize that those variable rates, they have to rise not only dramatically, but early in the loan for you to come out behind, taking that over a fixed rate, especially when you're comparing a variable 5-year to a fixed 10 or 15 year loan. So I think taking those shorter loans also gives you a little motivation to really get it paid off quickly. I mean, I don't know any docs that have paid off their loans quickly that regretted it. Nobody regrets it. They're all happy to be done.
Yeah. You
know? So, I mean, it's great to get that tax break of maxing out that, you know, SEP IRA or that 401k or whatever. The tax breaks are great. And I think it's wonderful if you can max those out and get your loans paid off in less than 5 years. But if I had to choose, I'd get rid of the loans in less than 5 years.
Yeah, that's good advice. Holsinger, talk about your situation a little bit.
I totally agree. Someone actually got into it one day on an episode about I wanted to pay my loans off, and Sully was told me not to.
Well, we did. So, we did kind of how I like it. It's good. Well, so I'm glad. I was ready to defer them. What's your rate?
I got 4.5. I just refinanced with SoFi. And so I got 4.5, 10-year, and I'm paying... I'm doubling my payment every month, so I can pay it off in 5 years.
Well, you'll probably be done in less than 5 years.
Yeah.
You'll probably be done in 4 doing that. So that's great. You'll be out of debt in less than 5 years.
And my argument to him at the time was I was like, well, what? But then if you're not maxing out your 401k and your Roth IRA, you know, doing backdoor IRA, then you're missing those opportunities in those years to do it.
Well, the truth is you're both right.
Yes.
Right? Yes.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with either one of your arguments.
And I think, and
every doc's got to figure out where on that spectrum he falls.
Exactly. And I think, and it's a total like how debt averse are you? How versus like I think that's really, you know, a good point. That's a great point. Is we're both figuring out.
But if you're taking that money and you're putting it in your 401k or whatever, great. But if you're taking that money and you're buying a Tesla with it, I got a problem with that.
No, I totally agree. Okay, what's the who's the first person from a financial standpoint that a high income professional needs to hire? At what point do you need to like hire somebody, and what area do you feel like it should be in?
You mean as far as a financial professional?
Correct. Yeah, it's like tax, insurance, financial advisor, any of that stuff.
Particularly if you own your own practice, the first person's probably a tax professional. I mean, I do my own taxes, but I don't think all docs need to do their own taxes. It's not that expensive to hire somebody to help you with that. And it can be pretty high yield. So I think that's probably the first person you ought to hire. Not only because they can help you with payroll and help you with your tax preparation, but hopefully they also give you some decent tax strategy advice. You know, if you're buying a home, you may need to hire a realtor relatively early too. You know, it's not exactly a great place to be out there on your own. But an insurance agent comes up pretty early too. I mean, you got to get that disability insurance. And if anybody else is dependent on you, that term life insurance in place early in your career. And so these are all people that you ought to have interactions with relatively early in your career. But a lot of this is transactional, right? You pay somebody a certain amount, they prepare your tax, pay them a certain amount, they do your payroll, pay them a certain amount, you know, a commission for your disability insurance, and that's it. You never pay them again. Same with the realtor, you know, it's commission up front, you never pay them again. Mortgage lender, same way. What you got to watch out for are these ongoing fees, like most financial advisors like to charge. You know, they typically, even a good fee-only advisor will want to charge an asset under management fee. And even a small number, like 1%, which seems like such a tiny number, that really adds up over 20 or 30 years. And you can find that a large percentage of what you saved ends up in their pocket. And so when you're paying ongoing fees rather than a transactional fee, I think you really have to be a little more careful about how much you're paying and whether you want to try to do that yourself.
What would you say the biggest mistakes that high-income professionals make in their financial realm throughout their careers?
Well, I think the big mistakes and the problem is when doctors make these mistakes, they're big, huge numbers. And so they turn out to really hurt them badly. But the big mistakes are things like not like growing into your income too quickly, basically not saving enough early in your career. That's the biggest mistake I see docs make. They come out of school and all of a sudden, boom, they're spending $150,000 a year. Last year, they lived on $20,000, right? But this year, yeah, they're spending $150,000. They got the big house. Their spouse has a car. They've got a car. It's all bought on debt. You know, now they got a practice loan. Now, you know, and they're going on these fancy vacations to Tahiti. So that's mistake number one, is just not taking those first few years to really build your financial foundation. Mistake number two is not getting the proper insurance in place. I mean, you got some real risks to your financial plan. You know, if you die and you're married and with kids, they're hosed, right? They've been planning on you having this high income for the next 3 decades. And now they got nothing. Not buying disability insurance. That's a big problem. It's, you know, a surprising number of docs become disabled. So you got to get that in place early on. Same with liability insurance, you know, both professional liability and personal liability. You got to have an umbrella policy in place in case somebody sues you because they slipped on your front walk or at your investment property or whatever. You got to have that insurance in place. So not having adequate insurance is a big, huge mistake. Another one is just buying investments that are designed to be sold, not bought, like whole life insurance. Almost every doctor is going to be propositioned to buy whole life insurance at some point, but it's not right for almost any doctor. I mean, it's a very small percentage for whom this is the right investment strategy. And so I think that's a big mistake I see often. And usually it's 2 or 3 years after the doc bought
it. Hey, Jim, this is Dad. This is Rick. Let me jump in. Let me jump in here a minute. Sure. I don't know about with the medical professionals, but I do know with the ADA. ADA, the American Dental Association, does have a term life policy that is nobody's ever been able to touch. I'm 54. I've had it since I was 25, and it's up to $3 million policy. So at least for the dentists out there, that's a real viable, easy option that's working for me. Of course, I'm still alive. But it's an excellent policy. You know, it is term. The rates are excellent.
But Jim, my question to that, though, is I know, and I've read stuff about talking about like group plan policies, that there's negatives to those, like a group, like the ADA's disability plan is probably not a great disability plan because it can be changed at any point, right? Is that kind of part?
There's upsides and downsides, both with disability and with term life, to using an individual policy versus a group policy. For example, with disability, if you have an individual policy and you leave that employer, you can take the policy with you. With a group policy, if you leave the employer, you can't take the policy with you. So that's one downside. But a big upside for a group policy is they might not ask all those pesky questions that an individual policy asks. For example, they ask you, do you go scuba diving? Do you go rock climbing? Do you jump out of airplanes? Have you had cancer? You know, all these medical, do you have high blood pressure? All these medical questions that the group policy may not care about. And you may get the same rate as somebody that's totally healthy and has no dangerous hobbies. And so, you know, I own both a group and an individual disability policy just for those reasons. With a term life policy, it can be similar. You know, if you have some dangerous hobby or you have some, you know, health problem, the group policy may be your best bet. But chances are, if that is not the case and you're very healthy and young and don't have any dangerous habits, chances are very good that you can get a better rate as an individual than you can through a group policy, even one through a professional association like the ADA.
Well, the other problem then becomes, too, is you've got to be a member. You have to continue your membership. And when you retire, you may not want to be a member of the ADA. I mean, you may or not, but that is something to think about, too, is what are our ADA dues? A couple hundred bucks a year?
They're around $1,000, a little over that in Tennessee. Each state is different.
So that could
I mean, hopefully, by the time you get to retirement, you don't need the life insurance policy anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea is to carry a term life insurance policy until you're financially independent. And once there's no financial consequences to your family of you dying, then you drop the policy and save the premiums.
How do you feel about doing a variable rated either disability insurance or life insurance based off trying to become financially independent before it would switch over to like cost you more money?
Oh, you mean like these graded premiums where
yes,
they start
correct.
Out low and then
uh-huh.
gradually increase?
Yeah,
I think if you are on a track and you're committed to becoming financially independent relatively early in your career, like say by 50, then I think you're going to come out ahead doing that so long as you cancel the policy when you get to be 50. But if you are actually going to hold it until you're 62, 65, then you're probably better off with the level one. Does that make sense? The nice thing about the level one is that it's at least it's not going up. You know what it is. You're locked into it. The variable one, sometimes it's not exactly in your control. And sometimes it can go up a little faster even than you expected. But those low premiums early on when you're trying to pay off student loans and max out retirement accounts, that's pretty nice to have those lower premiums early on, especially if you're planning for early financial independence.
Where do you feel like the market is and like in the economy and things? I mean, do you look at anything like that at all when you're looking at stuff, or are you just straight investing to invest and you're just planning it out for the long term and not worrying about any of the buzz that's going on in the world?
Yeah, there. It turns out that once you've been investing for a while, you realize there's buzz every month. Every month there's buzz. And yet I got money. I got to invest every month because I'm working. Every month I earn money. And some of it goes toward my investment. So every month I've got money to invest and I got to figure out whether I'm going to invest it or not. Well, the easiest thing that I've found to do is to get a written plan and follow it. So whatever your written plan says you're supposed to do, that's what I do every month, no matter what the market's doing. So we've essentially followed a written plan that we wrote up in 2004. And every month we invest according to that written plan. Now we've had a few very minor tweaks over the years, but essentially that's still the plan we're following. And we're now multimillionaires by following the plan. So I don't see any reason to really drop the plan or question the plan. The plan seems to be working pretty darn well. And so we just pour more money into it every month and follow it. So granted, do I expect returns for money invested in 2017 to be just as good as the returns on money invested in 2009? I don't. I mean, valuations matter, right? If you can buy stuff cheap, you're going to come off better. But the problem is, every time I look ahead, my crystal ball is cloudy, right? There's lots of people out there right now saying the market's overvalued, it's due for a correction. Well, guess what? They were all saying that a year ago, too. And if you took all your money out of the market before Trump was elected or whatever, you paid a heavy price for that. Because the market's up 10%, 20%, almost 30% in some countries. And so, it's very hard to predict the future. If you think you can do it, I suggest you practice first. Write down what your predictions are for the various asset classes and investments in the next year and take a look at it in a year, see how right you were. And I'll bet you'll become humble very quickly doing that because it's really hard to know what's going to happen in the future, despite what all the talking heads on TV say.
One of the big questions I get a lot of times are, and even I find it too, is like, you read The White Coat Investor, you find all this stuff out and you're like, you know what, this is stuff I want to do, this is stuff I want to implement, but I'm not Jim. I'm not, these guys. I need a little more handholding. I'm a little more unsure. I don't love to read books. I don't love to read blogs. I don't want this to be a hobby. How do I at least take the time to find the right person, right? Like, now you scared me to death. I don't want to go, everyone's out to get me. How does that person find the right person?
Well, I think the key is in the second opinion. For some reason, it's normal for someone to go get a second opinion from another dentist or from another physician. It's totally normal. We don't take offense to it. Great. Go talk to them, see what they think you need. But in the financial services industry, that's totally rare. Nobody ever goes and gets a second opinion. But if we did, we'd avoid the sharks far more often. But the basics of picking a financial advisor is, number one, know how you're paying them. If it's not clear how you're paying them, you're probably not paying them in a way that you would like, and you're probably not getting unbiased advice. You want a fee-only advisor that you're paying them for advice, not a commission on the products they're selling. Number two, you want to know how much you're paying them. Financial advice is expensive stuff. That's why a lot of people like me have decided to do it ourselves, because the going rate for financial advice is a four-figure amount, somewhere between $1,000 a year and $10,000 a year. If you're paying more than that, you're probably being ripped off, and you could get similar quality advice for less money. And so those are the first two things to look at. And then start looking at their investment philosophy. Does their investment philosophy jive with what you're learning on blogs and in books and on internet forums, you know, where people are telling you to invest in index funds or telling you to buy and hold? You know, all these unbiased sources are telling you to invest this way. Now, if your advisor is giving you some other story, you got to wonder if maybe that advice isn't so good. And so you want to look at their investment philosophy. It's also nice to have a few other things, like a meaningful designation. You know, the most common one out there is Certified Financial Planner, or CFP. That represents about 200 hours of coursework, which doesn't seem like a lot to a physician or a dentist, but it's actually a lot more than most financial advisors have. There's some other meaningful designations, like a CFA, a Chartered Financial Analyst, or a CHFC, Chartered Financial Consultant. That's for someone coming from the insurance world. It's basically a CFP for an insurance agent. And then you can get the Personal Finance Specialist, the PFS. That's basically is what accountants take. It's their version of the CFP. But you want to see one of those high-level designations rather than the 100 alphabet soup kind of designations that really don't mean much and that you can get in a weekend course. It's also nice to see a little bit of gray hair in your financial advisor. If this guy wasn't working with clients in 2008, you know, he's never really experienced a bear market.
It's kind of like a real estate agent right now that started in 2009.
Right. I mean, they tell you real estate always goes up. Well, real estate doesn't always go up, and the stock market doesn't always go up. And so you want someone with a little bit of experience so that when you get in the throes of the next bear market, which is coming, we don't know when, but it's coming, that they're not encouraging you to bail out at the bottom, because that's one of the worst mistakes you can make. You do that once or twice during your investing career, and you'd have been better off just investing in CDs the whole time.
What about, let's get back to the retirement. Now, how much do you have a formula or something as far as to make it easy for us to start investing into our retirement? Or what would you say to somebody who has no idea, like me? I have never put anything. I'm just like living like by the day. Like, how would I start learning more about the future? What are some of the things that you would say to people that want to know more about the future and they don't have, like, I'm single, no kids, I'm not married, and I've been thinking about myself the whole time. And right now I'm thinking about maybe in the future, even if I want to end up having, I mean, have kids and everything, like, what would I do? How do I begin? What are some of the things that you would tell those folks?
Well, I think from the beginning, once you start earning money, put 20% toward retirement. Now, unless you got big, heavy student loans that are keeping you from doing that, that's what I tell people to do. And do that for your entire career. 20% of your gross toward retirement. Now, put that into retirement accounts if you can, you know, a 401k or SEP IRA or whatever if you have it, a Roth IRA, either directly or more likely if you're a doctor through the back door, and then beyond that, in a taxable account. But you got to be putting that money away from the beginning so that you have options when you get to be 50 and 55 and 60 and 65. You'll be so glad you did that. You'll never miss it because you never had the opportunity to live on that income. Just do it right from the beginning. But as far as planning for the future, you know, you don't really know what the future is going to hold. I mean, maybe you get married and have kids, maybe you don't, you have no idea. But don't go buying a bunch of life insurance for something that you might not even happen. But when you get married, buy the life insurance. You know, when you have more kids, if you don't have enough life insurance, buy a little bit more. You know, you can do that. You can adjust as you go. It's not like you're stuck in one, you know, financial plan that you drew up when you were 23. And you're stuck in it for the rest of your life, you can adjust as you go along. And that's what we all do. You know, something comes up, grandma moves home with you or whatever, and you got to buy a bigger house. You know, you just adjust.
I don't know if I could buy any more life insurance. My wife made me buy a lot. I think she's a little greedy with the... I think I'm becoming more valuable dead to her than I am alive.
Well, hopefully you're building wealth at a rate that eventually you'll be worth more than your life
insurance. Yeah, exactly what I keep telling her. Dad, what do you think? What do you get? You get more questions?
Oh, I'm just listening. You know, I'm 54 and I got in the retirement plan late, the game late. You know, I'd done the IRA thing, but, you know, my accountant was more of a, you know, bayonet the wounded on April the 15th because, well, you could do a retirement account. But, you know, at this point, you know, I need $80,000-$90,000 or whatever. I'm like, hell, I don't have that. You know, I'm just trying to pay taxes. And so, you know, I've been using a planner, you know, a company that does dentists out of Dallas. And for probably 5 years now, and yeah, I've got a defined benefit plan. I've got a 401k through the office. Yeah, my wife works here. So, you know, we've been able to, you know, rack up a lot quickly, but at the same time, I'm dumping a lot in. You know, I made some lifestyle changes. You know, I sold the big house. I'm now in a 3,000 foot house with a $98 electric bill. So, you know, I've cut my mortgage in half. I've sold half my practice. You know, so I feel like I've got a plan and I'm working that plan. You know, I wish my advice to the younger guys listening would be, you know, start that plan sooner. You know, I mean, I had boats, I've got a lake home and I've got all the stuff. I have no regrets, but at the same time, you know, I love what I do. I could get specific personal questions to you, but, you know, I mean, my financial planners, I fall within the category of the fees that you quoted. You know, I pay them a monthly stipend. They're a fee only company. There is some asset under management fees that, Sully and I have discussed.
We get in arguments, Jim, and I think this is actually a good point. A good discussion is, you know, I really think that having a plan is really important, right? Kind of like you said, you started having a plan and you stuck with a plan, and you know we don't agree on some things as far as because I'm much more of want to do it myself. I don't want to pay $10,000 a year. You know, I don't want to pay assets under management. I want to passively invest in index funds. I don't want to do some of these things, but at the same time, if you're not doing anything and someone gets you to start putting away money and doing it in an appropriate way to a degree, there is some value to that. Would you agree with that? Or
absolutely. In fact, I think the best thing I do for a lot of doctors is get them into the hands of a good, competent financial planner who's charging them a fair price and giving good advice. That's one of the greatest services I do for doctors, because there's some people that just aren't do-it-yourselfers and they know that's going to cost them a little bit of money. But you know what? There's lots of things in life that cost money. You know, I don't winterize my own boat. I pay somebody else to do it. And that's just not how I want to spend my time. But people need to understand that financial advice is expensive stuff and that, you know, there's real consequences to paying somebody 1% a year of your assets under management. And it really does have an effect on how long you have to work and how much you have in retirement and how much you can spend in retirement. And if you're fine with that trade-off, I don't have a problem with that. But even if you're using an advisor, it helps for you to learn as much as you can because you get better advice. The more you know, the better advice you get because you know the right questions to ask. Whereas when you walk in there and you don't know squat and they know you don't know squat, they kind of take you by the hand and you know help you not destroy everything and help you have some level of success. But the more engaged you are, the more they can help you.
Yeah, and one of the things that Sully and I have been talking about, you know, is the whole do-it-yourself versus the financial planner thing is, you know, for instance, with my defined benefit plan, you know, there's a significant amount of cross-testing and those kind of things that go into play that I don't think I can do that kind of stuff myself.
Yeah, nobody's going to do, you know, practice retirement plans themselves. You know, if you're trying to run your defined benefit cash balance plan by yourself, that's probably a mistake, you know, because an actuary's got to go over that every year and make sure that's not screwed up. But if you're an independent contractor and all you're using is a solo 401k, you know, that's pretty easy to do it yourself. That can be a do-it-yourself project for sure. But once you have employees, it's worth hiring a little bit of professional help. You just got to watch the fees, make sure you're getting good advice, and make sure it's being done the right way from the beginning.
How would you evaluate financial planners? How do you, so you said the second opinion, which is good. Like, so you start talking with somebody and then you go to the next person. And what are some of the key points that we need to get from that conversation having with our financial planner that are like red flags for you to be like, okay, no, not this one. Can you kind of go over that a little bit more?
Okay, sure. If you've got someone that's wanting to charge you more than $10,000 a year, that's a red flag to me. That's just too much money. Because if you're paying 1% of your assets under management and you got $2 or $3 million, that's $20,000 or $30,000 a year in fees you're paying. you can find somebody that'll do a good job managing your assets for $5,000 a year. So paying 30 when you can get it for five, that's a mistake. That's a red flag.
How would you know they're doing a good job? Like, how do you, because we don't know anything. Like, what are some of the, or something that makes us be able to, like, differentiate a good versus bad, or somebody is decent some versus not? Because there's so many, in a dental world, so many people start coming out right now, for example, in the marketing world. They're like, oh, I'm a dental marketer. Or I'm a, like, dental stuff. And then you think, okay, well, they're dental people, so they know. Like, and then once you start learning about them, like, they don't know anything about what I do. And that's what, like, how would you come to find out these people are worth what they say? Like,
right. Well, it's like the old adage that why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. You know, why do people advise dentists? Because that's where the money is, right? And so you got to be a little careful there. Just because they say they specialize in dentists, most of the time what they really mean is they specialize in marketing to dentists. So there's a few ways, you know, the second opinion helps. Second, you've got to learn a little bit about this stuff. You know, it's kind of sad, but by the time you know enough to pick a good financial advisor, in a lot of ways, you know enough to do it yourself. But you can certainly get help by getting a second opinion. One of the best ways to get a second opinion is to just post your financial plan on a good internet forum, like the White Coat Investor Forum that I have on my website, or the Bogleheads Forum, and just get a few people that are do-it-yourselfers to take a look at it and say, yeah, that plan looks fine. I'd tweak it here and there. That's a good sign if that's all they say. If you post your plan there and they go, you're getting ripped off, and this is why, and they list 10 reasons why your plan sucks, you know you're getting bad advice. And I'm serious. In 30 seconds looking at a plan, I can go, you're getting ripped off, or you got somebody good.
Well, and you're
just
getting,
because I've been around and looked at that stuff. And so take advantage of that. There's people doing that for free. All it takes is, you know, 10 minutes of you getting your stuff together and typing it into the computer. And 20 minutes later, you got 10 different opinions on whether your plan sucks or not. You know, it doesn't cost you a thing. You might as well. Why not? You know,
I'm glad you brought this point up, because I want to talk to or I want to mention this in the podcast with a lot of folks that need to know, or they got to learn a little bit about your White Coat Investor blogs and forums. And can you talk about, OK, so you started the book and then it became a movement, almost like a. Okay. Now you have a blog. Now, can you talk about some of that stuff? Because it's kind of like, I want more folks to get on the website, because it feels like, I was going to ask you, like,
explain
what books.
Explain what all it has, basically.
Explain what you have, because I was going to ask you, like, what books do you recommend? Then I'm like thinking, like, if I come to the blog, it's probably easier. So can you go over some of the stuff that you do and make it easy for people to kind of get that knowledge on the tip of their fingertips?
Sure. The website is the first thing I started. You know, it's a blog. So three times a week, there's a new post put up there. But sometimes going through the old posts is far more useful than reading the new posts. So there's a tab at the top left of the blog that says start here. You know, and you can go there and you can subscribe to the monthly email, and you can, you know, find the stuff that's written for beginners. You know, if you're just starting out, the high yield topics. So you're not just wading through the 1,000 blog posts that are on this website. There's also, along that top row of the website, there's a recommendations tab. And under that, I have recommended books, recommended websites, recommended, you know, student loan refinancing companies, recommended insurance agents that I've vetted that aren't going to rip you off, recommended financial advisors that I've vetted that are going to give you good advice. You know, it's not going to be free. It's expensive stuff. But, you know, at least they're not going to rip you off. And, you know, and so a bunch of different other services, you know, tax strategists, you name it, I've got under that recommendations tab. But if you don't like reading websites, you don't like reading blogs, go to Amazon, pick up the book, The White Coat Investor. If you prefer listening to podcasts, like you probably do since you're listening to this one, there's a podcast, The White Coat Investor Podcast. You can find it on iTunes or anywhere else where you get your podcasts. And you can start listening to that. We put out two or three of those a month. I'm also working on a YouTube channel, and you know, any other way that I can get you to interact with people who are docs and know about this stuff, the better. You know, if you like internet forums, we've got an internet forum. If you, you know, like reading books, we got a book. If you like blogs, we got a blog. I'm just trying to get this information in whatever format you prefer it in.
It's so funny because you're like one of the very few people that we've had on this show that you don't like talk much other than you're so passionate about this stuff that it just makes me so motivated. Like, I want to do this, because we asked him about his journey and he talked like 10% of his journey about himself, but then 90% has been like how passionate he is to move and make other people aware of this, which I respect that. That's awesome. I'm happy to have you.
It's definitely got a missionary zeal to it. For sure. You know, I mean, I basically did it for free for 2 or 3 years.
I know. It's like,
so, you know, I mean, if I didn't care about it, I wouldn't have done that. But it's been exciting to see the financial success it's seen too. I mean, the white coat investor makes money. There's no doubt about it. It makes a lot of money now, which we're super grateful for. And we're trying to give back to the community, both to charities, as well as through the White Coat Investor Scholarship. This year, we gave away almost $40,000 in money to professional students and you know, who could really use the money, because that's when you really need it. Let's keep that debt down in the beginning by writing them checks. You know, our winner this year got something like $21,000, which keeps them from taking out a lot of student loans.
What do you? What's next for you? You think you'll continue to practice? You think you'll ever go full time white coat investor? Do you think you'll sell it and pass it off and move on, or what's next for you?
Well, what's next actually is going to come out tomorrow morning. I've got a 12-step series of emails that when people sign up for the email list on the White Coat Investor, they're going to start getting these emails once a week. And you know, they start out with disability insurance, then life insurance, and take you through step by step getting your financial ducks in a row. And so that's going to be going over the next 12 weeks. And then anybody who signs up later for it will get these again once a week for 12 weeks. Each one comes with, you know, a little chore at the end of it, something you need to go do that week. And it might be go apply for disability insurance if that's, you know, something you haven't done yet. But each one's going to have a chore. So that's what's new. We're working on an online course for those who like to learn that way. And, you know, but I anticipate continuing to practice medicine. Like I said, next summer, I'm going back to down to half time. But I expect I'll stay there for a long time, at least into my 50s, maybe into my 60s. I figure I can do that for a long time. I've already dropped my overnight shifts. And so I've basically taken all the painful parts of my job away, and I'm just left with the good parts. And so I think I can do this for a long time. But I'm hiring help with the White Coat Investor. You know, I've got some people helping me with editing and selling ads and that sort of stuff. So hopefully I can keep it manageable enough that I can keep that up for a long time. I'm trying to keep it to a sustainable level so that it doesn't, you know, overwhelm me and make me want to quit. But, you know, there's a little bit of a quest, and it's a big part of me. So I don't anticipate selling anytime soon.
How can people sign up for that and for the 12-step, the letters thing on your website?
All they got to do is come to the website, and on the upper right and a bunch of other places on the website, you can basically sign up for email updates. You just put your email address in there, hit enter, and you'll start getting the emails. That's all there is to it.
How many people do you have right now? I'm curious to know, like, what are the subscribers as far as the website goes?
Sure. Well, this is the most widely read physician or dentist specific personal finance or investing website in the world. So we get close to about 700,000 page views a month on the site. That's about 150,000 unique individuals. And but as far as newsletter subscribers, I think there's almost 14,000 of those that, you know, get an email from me every time I write something on the blog.
That's great. Awesome. Dr. Jim, thank you so much for doing this. We'll let you get on with your evening. But this has been great. I really appreciate it. I think this will be great for all of our friends and colleagues. And yeah, we appreciate it, man. We'll do it again sometime.
You're very welcome. I'd love to be back on. This has got to be one of the most fun podcasts I've been on yet.
All right, brother. Awesome. Take
good
it
to
easy.
Have you.
Work,
thank you
so everybody,
much.
Work smarter, not harder.
That's absolutely. Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Millennial Dentist. Visit us online at millennialdentist.com.